Let me begin by thanking you all for showing up for the panel on Sunday morning, and to Lenore Ely and Gary Gregg for their kind invitation to present at the Philadelphia Society this year. It's been a while since I've been to a meeting, and I'm pleased to be back and see many old friends, especially Bill Campbell. The theme for the conference is the question of whether or not the Constitution can be saved. And I would like to make a preliminary comment or two before I turn to my formal remarks. One is to put on the table something that hasn't been mentioned yet at the conference, and that is the importance of education, in particular the liberal arts and humanities, to the preservation of American constitutionalism. The depreciation of the liberal arts and humanities, especially in core curriculums in many universities, is a great threat to our constitutional republic, in part because young students then lose contact with the experiences and texts that engender the American constitutional order. And as STEM subjects continue to be treated with great primacy in the university, what we lose in part is contact with the history that developed our constitutional republic. That's comment number one. Comment number two is that in 15 minutes, it's difficult to deal with these very complex subjects, so I will use a metaphor to explain what I will be doing, and that is I'm going to paint. And I'm going to paint like an impressionist painter, very quickly, and there will be globs of paint. So first of all, the one drop of paint on the corner of the canvas, for those of you who might ask the question, is Hegel. And that's all I have to say about Hegel. The second thing is that I will paint until Judge Boggs tells me to stop. When Supreme Court justices decide cases, they bring to the case at hand pre-existing worldviews derived from their imaginations. In some instances, their imagination matters more than their technical knowledge of the law. Why, for example, have arguments to base court decisions on original intent fallen largely on deaf ears? Why did Justice Brennan and Justice Thurgood Marshall react so violently against originalism? In short, originalism does not comport with their imaginative conception of constitutional politics. As liberals, they favor progressive change and reform, things inconsistent with the constitutional values of the framers. Living constitutionalism, however, coincides with their desire to make American society more equal and more tolerant of personal differences. It also builds into the process of deciding cases and interpreting the Constitution the discretion to update the document to the needs of the day without concern for what the framers may think or the meaning of the text itself. The darkness of original sin and human depravity do not fit their imaginative conception of reality. Consequently, they are confident that expanding government power will lead to the public good, not tyranny. Justices who read the same briefs and review the same facts often come to radically different conclusions about cases. Justices also hold different views of the meaning of the Constitution. Imagination predisposes justices to see cases in the Constitution in a particular light. In some instances, the facts of the case have little to do with how a justice decides the legal dispute in question. The Court's Commerce Clause jurisprudence developed to a point where it accepted the idea that what Congress regulates doesn't have to be commerce, and if commerce, it doesn't have to be interstate commerce for Congress to regulate it. In the Court's Kelo decision, the Court took the Takings Clause to mean that government could take private property as long as it served a public benefit. The taking did not have to be for public use. In these instances, the Constitution becomes a dead letter. The force of imagination is so strong that the details of a case can easily be manipulated to fit a justice's ideological predilections. The debate between the two primary schools of constitutional interpretation, living constitutionalism and originalism, is a case in point. Contemporary Supreme Court justices cannot avoid weighing in on the debate, even if simply by imitation. Each theory is the expression of underlying intuitions about morality, constitutional law, justice, and the role of the Supreme Court in the American political system. One might expect each side, tends to exaggerate the virtues of its theory and the vices of its opposing theory. Such ideological skewing is a typical product of a fragmented imagination. Advocates of living constitutionalism like David A. Strauss and Geoffrey R. Stone describe originalism as, quote, incoherent, indefensible, artificially rigid, and static. Strauss states that, quote, there's no realistic alternative to a living constitution, close quote. Advocates of originalism, like Justice Scalia, argued that the most glaring defect of living constitutionalism, next to its incompatibility with the whole anti-evolutionary purpose of a constitution, is that there is no agreement and no chance of agreement upon what is to be the guiding principle of the evolution. Based on such criticisms of living constitutionalism, it is commonly characterized by originalists as arbitrary, elitist, undemocratic, and destructive of the rule of law. It is described as judicial oligarchy or even judicial tyranny. The role of imagination is rarely considered when analyzing the reasons why justices come to contrary decisions, and yet justices' imaginative orientation is central to the way they decide cases. Consequently, arguments for particular theories of constitutional interpretation are unlikely to be persuasive unless they appeal to imagination. Few have the imaginative power to change the way others think about and perceive life. Yet such influential human beings can alter the character of others, for good or ill, by changing their view of reality. Supreme Court justices are not likely to be imaginative masterminds. They are more likely to follow the vision of those who shape the thinking of the ages. Occasionally, justice will provide glimpses into their vision of life and the human condition. From these statements, it is possible to sketch their underlying intuitions that orient their decisions about legal disputes and the meaning of the Constitution. A few examples from recent Supreme Court cases will help illustrate the role of imagination in judicial decision-making. In the Windsor case, Justice Kennedy, writing for the majority, and Justice Scalia in dissent, exhibit contrasting views of the Constitution and the constitutionality of the Defense of Marriage Act, DOMA, that was struck down by the court. Following an approach consistent with living constitutionalism, Justice Kennedy, a Reagan appointee, argues that case law, Lawrence versus Texas in particular, has established the principle that, quote, private consensual sexual intimacy between two adult persons of the same sex may not be punished by the state. Kennedy's claim implies a common law approach to constitutional law. Judges create law or legal standards by deciding cases. In doing so, they have the prerogative to adapt the law or constitution to the needs of the day. Constitutional adaptation is at the heart of living constitutionalism. Kennedy asserts that DOMA served no legitimate purpose, and it was motivated by animus toward a class of people. The purpose of DOMA was, in his words, to defend the institution of traditional heterosexual marriage. Upholding traditional mores is not a legitimate function of government, in his view. To uphold a traditionalist view in this case would allow inequality into the law. Creating separate legal categories for heterosexual and same-sex couples demeans the couple whose moral and sexual choices the Constitution protects. It humiliates tens of thousands of children now being raised by same-sex couples, so says Justice Kennedy. DOMA is unconstitutional because it violates the liberty of person guaranteed by the Fifth Amendment. Kennedy's view of liberty expressed in Windsor is derived from the court's majority opinion in Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Kennedy authored the ruling in Casey along with Justices O'Connor and Souter, both appointed by Republican presidents. As a way of reaffirming the court's previous ruling in Roe v. Wade, the Casey majority articulated the meaning of liberty as protected by the 14th Amendment. Quote, "These matters involving the most intimate and personal choices a person may make in a lifetime, choices central to personal dignity and autonomy, are central to the liberty protected by the 14th Amendment. At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life. Beliefs about these matters could not define the attributes of personhood were they formed under compulsion of the state." In both Casey and Windsor, Kennedy embraces a progressive conception of liberty, the freedom to do as one pleases without government interference, especially state interference that is born of traditional morality. Kennedy's view of liberty is clearly not derived from an originalist approach to constitutional interpretation, and it consists and is consistent with his previous opinion in Romer that struck down a Colorado state constitution that prohibited local governments from enacting ordinances that banned homosexual discrimination. Justice Scalia dissented in Windsor, Casey, and Romer. In each case, Scalia argued that it is a legitimate state purpose to enact legislation that upholds traditional morality. He is not operating from the perspective of a progressive utilitarian, but as a democratic determinist who is sympathetic to traditional conceptions of morality. Democratic majorities are permitted under the Constitution to enact legislation unless such legislation is prohibited by the document. In his Romer opinion, he states that the Colorado law does not intend to harm homosexuals, but is a rather modest attempt by seemingly tolerant Coloradans to preserve traditional sexual mores against the efforts of a politically powerful minority to revise those mores through the use of the laws. The issue of gay rights is not, in Scalia's view, a constitutional matter, but part of the culture war that is appropriately decided by democratic politics. The Colorado Amendment was precisely the outcome of democratic politics. The majority opinion is based on political will, not judicial judgment. Scalia makes a similar argument in his Windsor opinion. In that case, the majority invalidates a law created by the democratic process, not because it violates the Constitution, which is silent on the matter, but because the court, in Scalia's words, is eager, hungry, to tell everyone its view of same-sex marriage. Scalia accuses the majority of judicial supremacy because it envisions a Supreme Court standing, or rather enthroned, we're going to miss these kind of comments on the court, at the apex of government, empowered to decide all constitutional questions, always and everywhere primary in its role. He adds that the majority's view of the court is foreign to the framers' conception of its role in the constitutional system. In Scalia's view, the controversy isn't justiciable because the dispute has been resolved by a lower court and has no real litigant with an interest in appealing the lower court's decision. It lacks adversariness and is being decided to create a public policy, not decide a real legal dispute. In Casey, Scalia based his opinion on the notion that states are free to allow abortion on demand or to ban it. In his view, the issue is not a constitutional one, but a matter for the democratic process to decide. American politics has been engaged in a debate about the proper approach to constitutional interpretation for some time. The Competing schools of thought operate from vastly different assumptions about law, judicial power, the meaning of the Constitution, as well as larger theoretical assumptions regarding human nature. The search for ways to save the Constitution requires a perspective that avoids the romantic tendencies and ethical abstractions of living constitutionalism, and perhaps the legal formalism and nostalgic romanticism of some varieties of originalism. A reformulated American constitutionalism synthesizes the need for change emphasized by living constitutionalists and the need for permanence promoted by originalists. An American constitutionalism that is old and new is characterized by several elements. It begins with the central role played by imagination in the human understanding, and it insists that imagination not be fragmentary, but push toward the wholeness of life. And I will just close with John Marshall as an example of someone who exhibited such an approach to judicial interpretation, which maybe we can discuss in the Q&A period. Thank you.
As I sometimes say in court, the gentleman's time.